Really warm welcome to you all into this session in the Dharma Hall we've co-created together. And it feels like a very precious space to speak into, one where silence and your dedication, your sustained individual intentions and our kind of collective intentions are kind of sitting here. And, you know, it may on the one hand feel like very little, can't feel anything, and on the other hand we could kind of see it as being something really quite significant, quite precious that's been created. And I was sharing in the group earlier that it's something that I really love to be in places like this with beings like you, beings who are interested in the human experience, interested in what's happening in the heart, the mind, the body in this moment, and interested in what we can do about it. So yeah, really deep bow to your dedication and kind of fulfillment of this deep wish that I think, you know, we all share, which is to gather and deepen together. And so this is the last evening of our, you know, daily retreat schedule. And so tomorrow we'll have a slightly different schedule, at least in the fact that it ends around lunchtime UK time. But it's the same up until 9:30, yeah, so the morning sitting and eating of breakfast will be the same. And later on this evening, I'll finish the coding of the web page so that we'll have a notice board that represents what's happening tomorrow. But, you know, if you go to bed before that's happened, then you can safely know that you can come and sit together 7:15 in the morning. So, you know, it's kind of noticing a funny thing in my mind, which is like, so what are you going to say next? And yeah, I kind of don't know. It feels like there's a few threads that I want to touch upon, but I just can't quite see which way to kind of step into that journey. So I think I'm going to hand over to the Buddha, and he gave this teaching. So let's say broadly, I'm going to speak about how do we keep this practice going. You know, maybe there's a couple more things that we can deepen, but also interested in sustaining, interested in expanding the field of where this practice can go. And so the Buddha said at one time, hey, you practitioners, I will teach you the all. Listen and pay close attention. I will speak. And then the ones gathered there said, as you say, Lord. And then it says in the sutta, the Blessed One said, what is the all? Simply the eye and forms, ear and sounds, nose and aromas, tongue and flavors, body and tactile sensations. Yeah, so we have the five, what we commonly call sense organs or sense doors, through which we experience. And then there's a sixth in the Dharma, you may know. So it says, the intellect and ideas. This is called the all. Anyone who would say, repudiating this all, I will describe another. If questioned on what exactly might be the grounds for their statement, would be unable to explain. And furthermore, would be put to grief. Why? Because it lies beyond range. It lies beyond range, beyond the range of the what the eye can perceive, what the ear can perceive, what the nose can sense, what the tongue can taste, what the body can feel, tactile sensations, and through the intellect and ideas. This is the all. This is the human life experience. Yeah. So it's worth just noting one more thing here. Intellect and ideas is but one translation of this. Ideas here in the original Pali is Dhamma, right? So you might know the Buddha Dhamma. The Dhamma is the, you know, the law. The law, not as in a legal sense, but more like as in a physical law, like the laws of physics, or the, you know, this is the way things come about. And particularly the laws of appearances. And particularly, as you'll know, the Buddha was focused on the law of appearances of stress, distress, disharmony, entanglement. Yeah. How does that come about? What's the laws and principles, yeah, that bring that about? But also the word Dhamma, like a few other words in Pali which do at least double duty, it also means things. It also means appearances themselves. So the intellect and the world of appearances. Every other appearance that could possibly be. Yeah. So it's not just your ideas when they say intellect and ideas. It's kind of an attempt to kind of point towards that. You could also say all experiences. Yeah. So anything that you experience, anything at all, is this is the all. And why this teaching, I thought to start with it, if I thought at all, was because I want to really lay out this sense of this Dharma journey, that there's a philosophical principle called phenomenology or something like this. Phenomenology. It's a good word, but I can't say it right. So phenomenological or phenomenology or something like this. Yeah. Anyway, the sense of what can be directly experienced, the experiential life. Yeah. And what can also be experienced are theoretical things, yeah? But really bringing this sense away from the metaphysics, away from the superstition kind of ideas, away from our created mythologies, to what's here, what's knowable. You know, this is our arena of exploration. This is where our study takes place. This is where our work gets done. You know, this is where our play is played. This is where the creative art of meditation is undertaken. And as we draw our attention towards this, we're interested in both the Dhamma of appearances and also the Dhamma of the law and principles that give rise to that. How did this come to be in this way? To the sufficient degree so that I can see, is there some way I can release, support, open, soften, empower, yeah, what's beautiful, let fade what's harmful, unhelpful. So within this perspective, you know, the seeker of awakening, if we want to call ourselves that, yeah, starts with the given. Ah, what's here? And then we go from that through the direct experience, the five senses and the sixth sense of the intellect, through this framework of like, how is this contracted? How is this expanding? How is this building up? How is this softening down? And so what we're going into there is to discover how things co-arise, yeah, and what they depend upon. So you may have noticed the webpage that we use for the notice board is, the website's called Dependent Origination. Yeah. The Dependent Origination of Experience. And something that we've had kind of going through the themes of this retreat is, you know, exploring how our experience is dependent on attention. Yeah. To experience something right now, you have to attend to it. You know, you have to let your attention land on a specific object to have that experience. if you choose, or the mind just wanders away onto some other object of attention, you will have a different experience. Yeah, there'll be a different phenomena in attention. So the dependent origination of experience is dependent on an object to pay attention to. But something that's more subtle and potentially more profound is the how we attend to that. Yeah? The emotional quality, the energetic quality of how I attend to that. If I attend to it like a feather in the palm of the hand, yeah? Or if I tend to it like, you know, attention hitting it like a hammer hitting a nail, yeah? And of course, we have such a range of what we can do, really penetrate something, really land on something. You know, you ever want to like look at someone like, yeah, I'm looking at you, you know, I'm annoyed with you. You feel the power and the penetration in our gaze. And then we can look at something like, ah, you're so beautiful, so delicate. We have all of that range of the how we can attend to things. And they fabricate, they shape, they create our experience. So there's this all of the all. What are you sensing in this world of things? Which of the sense doors are you bringing towards this? And how? How are you engaging with this? And if we just pause at this real level of the subtlety, there's another kind of point in all of this, which is actually, what are you conceiving this to be? What are you conceiving this to be? So within that how we pay attention, there's also the concept of the very thing. You hear a sound, a tweety tweet vibration. It's like, oh, that's that bird. Maybe it's that blackbird with the yellow beak, and maybe it's that same one I saw before. And the concept appears, and that experience is born. Yeah, we hear something. It's like, oh, I don't know what that is. It's like, oh, I know now. It's a car reversing. It's like, and then the image appears in the mind, the felt sense. Experience is dependent on the concept. And the mind is very bright, very sharp at creating those. Nothing appears in perception without the idea of its conception. Yeah. Every Dhamma, every appearance is conceived, must be conceived in the mind, shaped in some way. And this isn't just a trippy thought, yeah. This is actually a freedom teaching. So, how am I conceiving this? So, you might notice that you can bring that into being in connection with the breath. And what is this breath I'm conceiving when I'm practicing? What is a breath? So, oh, I'm sitting here breathing and I'm breathing out and then I'm breathing in and I know that I'm breathing in and it's in the Mindfulness Sutta, you know, it's like knowing that you're breathing in when you're breathing in, knowing that you're breathing out when you're breathing out. And I would say, imagining that I'm breathing in while I'm breathing in, imagining that I'm breathing out while I'm breathing out, because I'm not really sure what a breath is. I've looked around for them, never managed to find one anywhere. Yeah. This kind of collection of sensations that feels like it represents something. And there's a whole way of practicing with the breath that we might breathe in and out of areas of pain. Yeah, this might be really, really useful, really soothing to breathe out through my knee. Yeah, breathe in, kind of giving space, giving soothing, breathing out again through the knee. And we're just fantasizing that this is how I'm breathing. Yeah, it's really, really useful, and it feels like a mindfulness practice. Feels mindful, but I'm completely fantasizing that I'm breathing in and out through my knee, and I personally love to do that. Yeah, especially if my knees are achy, breathe in and out of my back of my body. Or maybe I'll sometimes elongate the sense of the breath so it really comes right down into the hips. You know, ah, oh, such a nice way to breathe. Yeah. Or you might say, no, I don't do any of that. I only breathe with the anatomy that I learnt in biology class when I was a kid. That's what a breath is. It fills up these big sacs that are kind of, if I remember rightly, they're kind of lots and lots of little broccoli florets inside these big sacs in here, and they come down to somewhere around the ribs. I can't remember exactly, but you know, it must be out there, that information somewhere. That's again, it's a concept. It's a concept. You know, how many of us have seen inside a body, let alone our own bodies? But that's what a breath is. No, that's what a breath is. Don't give me any of this, you know, breathing in and out of the knees rubbish, you know. So you see, experience is dependent on the conception. And this matters in a world of uncertainty. This matters how we conceive that. Oh, it's a world of uncertainty. And Zohar said something really beautiful yesterday, that we can focus on the anicca of the impermanence of things. Oh, everything changes. There's nothing reliable, nothing we can hold on to. Or there's that feeling, everything's changeable, everything's developable, everything's expandable, everything's growable. Yeah? How we meet the certainties, how we meet the uncertainties, how we conceive of what should or shouldn't happen within my life. You know? Living at the moment in, you know, we're still in the middle, who knows, towards the end of this pandemic of sickness and ill health. You know, in the Buddha's teachings, you know, we said this phrase, you know, brothers and sisters in aging, sickness and death. Sickness is a certainty in life. And yet we might classify it as like, oh, meeting the uncertainties. It's like, no, sickness is a certainty. But we act surprised, yeah, and kind of see these other recollections. And so I shared with us such a beautiful way to bring them into being. Now, what was it? As I breathe gently, I lovingly remember, I am also subject to sickness. You know, that concept, oh, how did, what? No, of course. This is what's going to happen. This is what's inevitable to happen. This uncertainty, I conceive as an uncertainty. It's really a certainty. Question of timing, perhaps. So we look at the phenomena, we look at the appearances, but those appearances only happen due to the ideas, the concepts, the holding, the all of that, all of that. And so this is our reality, yeah? When we sit on the cushion, this is what's happened. This is what's happening. When we go out into the world, into our lives, with the more dynamic, more unpredictable perhaps ways of being, this is what's happening. We have appearances, and we have our conceptions of how things should be. We have our conceptions of how things are being. And when those are, have a disharmony between them, we have the distress, we have dukkha, we have disharmony. Yeah? So practicing on the cushion, practicing off the cushion, what are the differences? What are the similarities? And within our range of concepts, do we tend to look for differences or tend to look for similarities in things? So most humans that I've met, sorry if that's a weird way of putting it, have a tendency for seeing the differences, yeah? And we can kind of see this. The sources of conflict, yeah. How different others are to me. And I come into this Dharma circle and, you know, and I'm doing this kind of meditation and everyone else is doing this other kind of meditation. It's not the right meditation, you know, or these people don't meditate and I do, and this is what's different about us. So much in common. We share so much in common, but we might end up focusing on the differences. Yeah. And so when we're practicing here in silence, stillness, and community of like-minded beings, and then we go out into the world, and it's like, oh, it's so different. Everyone's so different. But also, everyone's just the same, aren't they? Yeah. They're all breathing, all thinking, all feeling. We have sensations. Everyone's all, most of us are overtired, overstretched. Not entirely sure why we're here. Into this great mystery and just trying to figure out if we can get through it okay without hurting anyone else and not hurting ourselves. So there are kind of universal things which are true, yeah? When we want to be mindful, when we want to be present, what's useful? What's supportive? Good posture. So at any point in time, you can just check yourself. Am I actually in a good posture? How's the form of the body right now? Yeah. And if we're not sitting comfortably, are we expecting to be comfortable anyway? That concept sneaks in there. Yeah. And also just to say, within the realm of form, yeah, we'll speak a little bit more about this. When the Buddha speaks about fabrication, he actually spends quite some time talking about the rupa fabrication, which sometimes gets translated as bodily fabrication. Yeah, but it's actually more to do with the form of things, the world of things. Yeah, you notice how sometimes you end up sitting in the same seat in a dining room table or something, or you end up, always taking the same seat on a bus or in places. It's like you have these habit grooves. And we start repeating these patterns instead of thinking, where would be the best place for me to sit now with the conditions of heart and mind that I have now? Who would be the best person to sit next to now? Start bringing more and more intentionality into the form of things. Oh, maybe I should turn around and face the window today. Maybe I should, what is it I need to do? So that I create the forms which are supportive for the sensitivity for the things that I wish to develop, yeah? So if our goal is presence, what else is good there? And I would say going slower than we can, yeah? So one of the human defaults is I should go at, kind of like 2 times the speed of what would be the right speed for me. I'll do it as quick as I can and then it'll be done and then I'll get on to the next thing. But when it comes down to presence, can we do it slower than we can? Can we do it just a little bit more sensitively? Can we be present? Thich Nhat Hanh used to say, can you be present in the washing up so that you can later be present in the cup of tea after the washing up? Yeah. And so that's where the real practice is, yeah? Like going slow here. The other quality that really supports that, so we have form, we have going slow, staying relaxed. Have you ever noticed that when you're not relaxed, you tend not to be mindful? When you're more relaxed, you tend to be more mindful, more present. It's like presence likes a relaxed body. It's also good for our stress levels, and it's good for our steadiness. And so you see that all of these are starting to open something. Yeah. Once we start to get these qualities here, then I feel like it's the seeds of the heart qualities are starting to be planted. Right. Getting ourselves comfortable, getting ourselves in the right place, going slow, being relaxed. All acts of kindness. They're all acts of kindness. There's metta in the practice. Right? It's all part of beginning well. Wherever we are, on the cushion, in life, before having a conversation, before starting a task, whatever it is, it's all part of beginning well. And right in the heart of that, and also holding it like a large, loving embrace, is this equanimity quality that supports us to get to know what's here. What's here? And once we've gotten to know what's here, we can start to question, it's like, oh, is there is this fabricating dukkha? Is the way that I'm relating fabricating dukkha? Yeah. So this very idea, focusing more on differences, yeah, than seeing the similarities, starts to build up this disharmonization in the kind of, not necessarily what you might hear as like the first suttas of the Buddha, but there's this kind of historical view of it, like the oldest suttas, like the suttas which it appears were written in the most ancient times, or record the earliest teachings in a sense. Dukkha is often not used, but actually quarrels and disputes is the kind of phrase that's used. To be in a quarrel and dispute with what? With life itself. To be having an argument with existence. Yeah, I think it's a wonderful description for this word, dukkha. Yeah. Am I arguing with life today? And the Buddha didn't make a great deal of rules about like what is life like, really. Yeah, in my eyes. But there are things called these three characteristics that were kind of underpinning this, to support an understanding of where I might be arguing with life. Am I arguing with life by saying things are permanent, they're fixed, they're not changing? Yeah, it's one of the default settings of the human being. Ah, if I get this, you know, whatever. Or I find myself now, all of a sudden, only in the last 5 seconds, acting a certain way, and I say, I've always thought this, I've always believed this, I'm always like this. And it's like, and I know 5 seconds ago I wasn't actually like this at all, and in 5 seconds time I won't be, but I am like this, and it's a big deal, and I can't stand myself for being like this. And that fabricates the sense of it, and I can actually stay within a fixed idea of having an argument with life and with myself, which seems absolutely ridiculous. Like, surely only human beings can have an argument with themselves, but we do. By taking something as fixed, which clearly can't be. Yeah. And then we get involved in this entanglement, this not seeing that dukkha is dependent on these demanding on things. Yeah, demanding on things which can't offer this. This is the second characteristic. Demanding for things to stick around when they can't. Demanding things to go when they've only just arrived. You know, demanding for life to be different. Demanding for otherwiseness. Demanding to be in control in an uncontrollable, dynamic, you know, dependently arising, but not dependent on me alone. Experience, yeah. And then this third truth, do we take as I, as me or mine? What is stressful? What's not in my control? What's not able to last? These are my thoughts, you know, these are my feelings. This is my role. That's my chair. All of these things, yeah. How quickly identification gets latched onto something and ownership. Yeah. People come on a meditation retreat and, you know, take a cushion from the back of the hall, put it down on a bit of carpet that they've never seen before, and then all of a sudden think, this is my spot. If you could, you'd build a little fence around it. You know, say, oi, keep off. You know. Or if you're at one of these communal gatherings and you come along with your plate, it's like a massive pot of food and a communal spoon, and it's somewhere just before it drops off the communal spoon onto this plate that wasn't my plate until 5 seconds ago, it's my food. And if anyone comes and takes any of this food, there will be big trouble. Well, you know, you can have the rest of the pot, I don't care about that, unless it's come out of there and it's landed on my plate. And this idea of identification constricts us. You know, we can see, there's dukkha here. There's dukkha in that feeling, this is my plate. Even that, even the subtle thing there. And then so much more so with this is my body. This is my body. Yeah, it belongs to me. I take it everywhere with me. Admittedly, I don't take particularly good care of it. I fill it up with sweets and I don't exercise it anywhere near as much as it needs, but it's my body. And that's an interesting thing, because isn't that actually why I treat it so badly? Because of that misunderstanding, thinking it's mine, thinking it's mine. It's not mine, it belongs to nature. I'm just looking after it. Or at least I should be. Yeah. It heals itself, it digests food and turns it into energy, it does the breathing and it keeps the heartbeat going, but it's still mine. I mean, come on. Can't be anyone else's. Like, clearly, this is a piece of nature that I'm just honored to be able to wake up and look after. But yet, I mistake things and I end up in this argument with life. Some of those arguments are quiet, silent arguments, but they're still arguments. They're not based on reality, they're not arguments I could argue for. Yeah, I wouldn't argue this is my body against the point that this belongs to nature, will return to nature, it belongs, it's only on loan. Yeah. And so I think within this whole framework, this is one of the reasons why you'll see that in the Dharma there's this emphasis on wise and virtuous speech. And the definition for it is only to say that which is true and useful. Only to say that which is true and useful. And when you really come down to being able to say what's true only, is I think you probably realize why, the Buddha suggested that the monks didn't speak so much. Take a vow of silence, because we only want true things said around here. The amount of time we waste on not saying the truth, yeah. Or saying things which we don't even believe are true. I'm just like, I'm just trying out some ideas on my friends and family to see if they. If anyone can help me realize which bits are true and which bits are not. But it's interesting within this framework of true and useful. And I almost think let's just really lean into the useful. All the concepts that we can have are limitations. We can't have perceptions until we've had conceptions. And when you bring a conception into being, then is what we perceive true or not true? If it's dependent on the concept, it seems tricky to say. But if we check in with the contraction or remain sensitive to the kind of micro transient changes within the human life experience, maybe we can feel what's useful, what opens the heart, what brings kindness, what brings value. So then we see speech not as right or wrong, but as what's wise, what's courageous, what's virtuous, what's beneficial. So in a sense, forgetting about what's true and leaning into what's useful obviously brings the question of useful for what? And so within the Dharma, it's useful for the release of dukkha, useful for the ending of arguments, useful for the ending of quarrels with existence itself, quarrels with others, quarrels over limited resources, so that we can share this world, which has enough. But that's not how we live, right? We even see, we can't find reliable truths, but we can find reliable usefulnesses. There's even no permanent concept of Dharma across beings and time. Freedom from what? Freedom from what? From dukkha. But then what's dukkha for you? What does it mean? We said before, the Buddha is extending this boundary. Dukkha is any appearance. Do you want freedom from that? Dukkha is suffering, difficulty. Of course, we want freedom from this. And so it's really good that we have these principles to look at and this framework, you know, oh, am I in a quarrel? Because when we get that view lined up, that understanding, wisdom and freedom co-arise. Wisdom and freedom co-arise. What we understand becomes this insight, the insight, the deep understanding, the wise and skillful view brings freedom. So we can really have this primacy of questions, also a primacy of intentions. A good question for us is, how is this fabricated? This all of the all, this experience that I'm having. Ah, the sense door of sight, seeing this. What's the experience of that? What's the experience in the body? What's the experience in the thinking in the mind, you know, the chatter in the mind? Oh, I need to get that. Oh, if I get that, I could give it to someone else. If I get that, I could keep it for me. Maybe I should get rid of that. Maybe that needs to move away. I keep fiddling, annoying. Ah, so the verbal chatter in the mind is dissatisfied. What am I attending to? What am I turning away from? How am I positioning myself, the form of this moment? And as we get to know these, and also know all of these are flexible. Yeah, when we use the metta practice, we're actually using what's called verbal fabrication, the skillful use of words to shape experience. Whenever you're doing your meditation practice, you're being skillful with the bodily fabrication, placing the body, relaxing the body, stilling the body to still the heart and mind. You're also playing with what's sometimes called mental fabrication. I think perhaps for now we'll call it attentional fabrication. Where we're placing the attention, how we're placing the intention. And every moment of attention needs its intention. I'm intending to soften, intending to attend with kindness. Yes, we have the body to play with, the verbal thoughts and the attention. So we can intentionally fabricate and we can unintentionally fabricate. And so that's always in the realm of freedom. We can do that on a retreat, we can do that in our life. Yeah? So we don't just take, oh yeah, well this is the default. You know, we've probably all said or heard at any time, well this is just how I am. This is just the way I am. Yeah. So what we would say is, this is just the way I am becoming right now. I could be another way also. I can't remember there's a Groucho Marx joke, something like that, isn't it? Like, these are my principles, and if you don't like them, I have others. This is who I am, and if it's not convenient, I can shape through the body and through the words and through the attention to actually develop myself into something more awake, if that would be convenient. If you can just give me a couple of minutes, I just need to cross my legs and sit on the floor. And so we have this wisdom available to us, yeah, but we don't bring it alive until we bring that wisdom into alignment with our intentions, with our views, our understandings, our wisdoms, comes through, brings freedom. And so the Eightfold Noble Path, it starts with this wise view. Yeah, and it steps into this skillful intention. Yeah, later on it gets up to speech and other actions and efforts, and it's a really great thing to explore, the Eightfold Path. Sometimes called intentions, sometimes called thoughts, sometimes called resolve. Yeah. And so, this one of my favorite suttas is called Two Sorts of Thinking. Yeah, it could be two thoughts, two sorts of resolve, or two sorts of intentions. And it says, the Blessed One said, dear practitioners, before my self-awakening, when I was still just an unawakened bodhisattva, the thought occurred to me, why don't I keep dividing my thinking into two sorts? So I made thinking imbued with sensuality, thinking imbued with ill will, and thinking imbued with harmfulness, one sort, and thinking imbued with renunciation, thinking imbued with non-ill will, and thinking imbued with harmlessness, another thought. Okay, so with all of these suttas, there's so much to dive into, but like the simplicity of this idea is like just two big baskets and you're just thinking, oh, I'm loads of thinking. It's like, well, is it that type of thinking or is it that type of thinking? So basically, is this dukkha thinking or is this release thinking? You know, clearly we can kind of see where the Buddha's going there. But just in that sentence that's translated earlier on, the thought occurred to me. You know, what a skillful use of language. If we just adopted that, I think this would be like radical. Ah, oh, the thought occurred to me. You know, not I am thinking, or it's like, you know. So if a thought of sensuality occurs to you, that means it just, I don't know, it fell out of the roof, or it, you know, kind of flew in through the window. A thought imbued with ill will occurred to me. You know, just like the neighbor's radio occurs to me. You know, what am I going to do when it occurs to me? I may decide to listen to it or not. Yeah. I may decide to close the window and go indoors or not. I may choose to indulge. Yeah. So these thoughts, some are harmful, some are harmless. Some are greedy, some are generous. Some are selfish, some are more open. In short, some are leading to dukkha, some are leading to release. And what's interesting in this sutta is that the Buddha doesn't say, and you know what, all thinking, it's just rubbish. Never think, you know. My teaching is, never think, just be, without thoughts, free, absolutely free. But no, don't think the thoughts that harm you and harm others. So the Buddha says, and that noticing, discerning, actually, that there are thoughts arising concerned around kind of greed for sensual pleasures or rejection, ill will towards anything, you know, other beings, but also other concepts, perhaps even, so many subtle areas, or any kind of harmfulness, wanting to crush, wanting to destroy, wanting to kick out of life. Notice that leads to my own affliction, or to the affliction of others, or to the affliction of both. It obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, and does not lead to unbinding. This is not peaceful, he could have said there, yeah? And as I noticed that it leads to my own affliction, it subsided. The wisdom alone subsided it. As I noticed that it leads to the affliction of others, to the affliction of both, that it obstructs discernment, promotes vexation, and does not lead to unbinding, it subsided. So the wisdom there. But then a little bit more intentionality comes in. Whenever thinking imbued with sensuality, imbued with ill will, imbued with harmfulness had arisen, I simply abandoned it, dispelled it, wiped it out of existence. And I really enjoy that phrase, wiped it out of existence. This thought that was going to cause ill will, it's going to cause harm to me, harm to another, as I tried to get my bit of the cake so no one else could have it. Yeah. As I tried to, you know, get rid of you before you try and get rid of me, or whatever that harmfulness story was. Seeing this is dukkha, this is not peaceful, this is not harmonious, this does not lead to my release. This is harmful for me, harmful for others, and not just those in the story, yeah, it's harmful for multiple others. And it's just, actually, oh, it's endless. It's endless because these thoughts just keep coming. But gaining this skill is so important. Buddha makes this declaration: whatever a practitioner pursues with their thinking and pondering, that becomes the inclination of their awareness. Right? Get into the slipstream of our thinking. And then, you know, when I notice that this thinking of gratitude, of kindness, of compassion were arising, and the release that you get from that, even this thinking, though, will tire us. Even this isn't peaceful. And I discerned thinking imbued with renunciation, with non-ill will, with harmlessness has arisen in me, and that leads neither to my own affliction nor to the affliction of others, nor to the affliction of both. It fosters discernment, promotes a lack of vexation, and leads to unbinding. If I were to think and ponder in line with that, even for a night, even for a day, even for a day and night, I do not envision any danger that would come from it. Thoughts of renunciation, non-ill will. Sometimes we say in the positive, thoughts of metta, thoughts of kindness, harmlessness, or maybe even compassion. Yeah. But there's a comma, that wasn't a full stop, and the Buddha says, except that thinking and pondering a long time would probably tire the body. So don't do too much of it. And then he continues, because when the body is tired, the mind is disturbed, and a disturbed mind is far from concentration, far from being gathered and unified. And so I steadied my mind right within, settled, unified, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind would not be disturbed. And so I got over-enthusiastic about the sutta there, but I think it's a really delightful one. And it actually continues, and there's some really lovely imagery in there about discovering this path. And also within this story, this Buddha carries it through from being, you know, a mere bodhisattva of great practice to being a fully awakened Buddha who discovers or rediscovers a path to this freedom that was hidden for a long time. And so hopefully there's a possibility to open out and feel the potential within there, to feel a sense of empowerment, a sense of agency in our own existence. Yeah, there's an encouragement to be the angels of change, to the angels of our better nature, as was said. Yeah. So that we can live a kindly life, to look with kindly eyes, to not imagine that it's a loss for me, yeah, to be kind. You know, in various suttas where they explore beings that are really deeply soaked in these practices, or anyone that you know who's really engaged with this will see, ah, they're also agents for change, you know, angels who wish to bring the best out in others, to change the world for good. Yeah. And you know, we have this sense that they will say, you know, it's a gain for me if this one here is happy, this one here is peaceful, just like living embodiments of these metta phrases, yeah, that us lowly bodhisattvas are saying, yeah, but really meaning, I do want all beings to be free, to be unburdened, That's what would make me the most happy. So that's what I work for. That's the intention I set, yeah. In my basket of thoughts that come up, you know, the baskets that lead to a lack of vexation, an increase in harmony, so that I can live the life, you know, that I want to live, that we can live the life that speaks to us, that meets our beauty we wish to see. So we said earlier in the retreat, you know, this Mary Oliver poem, what will you do with your one wild and precious life? Maybe buy a couple of baskets for your thoughts. I like this phrase from Pema Chodron where she says, we work on ourselves to help others, and we also help others to work on ourselves. And we used to have that on the homepage of Sangha Seva, the website that we have to support bringing meditation into action. And I just want to kind of mention this just briefly, just take a couple more minutes of your time, is this sense that there are great challenges in our life. We have collective challenges and we have individual challenges. And we can have this feeling that we turn away from these challenges because they're too hard. It's too difficult, and that really what we want is a life without challenge. But I feel to really question that concept that underpins that. Am I really afraid of challenges? Or is it actually that I'm seeking challenges? The kind of person who comes on a retreat doesn't quite seem to me to be the kind of person that's afraid of challenges. To come into silence, to listen deeply to their experience. Maybe there's a secret here that we really love challenges, that challenges are what bring us alive. That we actually want to be challenged. We want something beautiful, something meaningful. So I'll leave that one just out there in the space. And we'll speak tomorrow to a little bit more about how we can make these transitions well, and more places and collectives that we can join together with. And we'll give, as Zohar said, the sutta links. So that if you want to read some of these in the semi-original, so like the translations, you can access those. And if you want to teach yourself Pali and read them in the original, then you'll be able to follow those through from there. So okay, let's just have a quiet minute together with the all of the all. So thank you for your listening this evening, and thank you for your practice.
Thank you for listening. To To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.